This is fun! The FU Network.
Well, our episode on the illogic of racism, I suppose, was prescient. This is the Broken Clock Podcast, coming to you from places that are not on fire or looted. Fortunately, I'm here with Mouse Mary Jess. Mouse, you're closer to the epicenter of it than I am, definitely. Though I was talking to a couple people in Winnipeg, and they say they even feel the sort of tension wafting up over the border from Minneapolis. So the topic today is how to stay rational when everything around you is rage. And I think, people aren't quite in listening mode yet, shall we say. So we're going to try to aim for coping mode. But it's us. We're going to speak our minds. Mm-hmm. We're both pretty intellectual beings, and I think intellectual people tend to process stress by thinking things. I think the challenge is to not overthink things. But Mouse, since you live in the U.S., I'm going to let you open this up. Where do you want to start?
Well, first of all, I'm going to do a quick analysis, because the first thing a lot of people will think that when they hear that the center of the topic of this podcast today is how to remain rational and centered when everything is rage around us, it is very easy for people to assume that we are telling people who have been victimized how to react, and that is not the case.
No.
For those listeners who may not be familiar with the particulars of the mess that has been America for the past couple of decades in this situation, we have a section of a population, a minority, people of who are Black, who for the past several decades have seen a rise in police brutality, in the galling murder of people from their community by figures in authority, by officers allegedly of the peace, who in most of these cases end up getting off with a slap on the wrist for offenses that, had it been the murder of a white man or a white woman, would have been scandalous, that would have been increasingly more drastic measures taken against that police officer.
Well, case in point, a Black cop in Minneapolis shot a white woman. She was an Australian national. This was only, this was fairly recently. I remember seeing it on the news. He got, 12 years?
Yeah.
12 years in prison for manslaughter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it wasn't, there was no outcry. It was just done. And I think I don't see that being mentioned very much, but that's one of the things that got me really frustrated. There's all this talk about protecting cops. Let's face it, it's not protecting cops. It's protecting white cops. And this is this is something unique to the U.S. in a lot of ways. I know up in Canada, we had the killing of Sammy Yateem. And the cop actually was, I think he got convicted of second degree murder. And it was very controversial, not because people thought he did something wrong, but he didn't do anything wrong, but because there was an argument of whether it was the cop or whether it was lousy training. Mm-hmm. Or whether he should have been a police officer in the first place. And the debate up here is whether charging police with murder lets the system off the hook.
Right.
That's obviously a much more rational debate than what's going down there.
Yes. And the problem, one of the biggest problems aside from this, so we have had a population that has seen its members killed almost indiscriminately with very little repercussion for decades now. Mm-hmm. There has been an increase in the militarization of police starting around the time of the George Bush era, escalating through Obama's administration as well. There was a good amount of militarization there. And of course, during the Trump era as well.
I'm glad you correctly identify the start of the true militarization of police, because there's a lot of, I don't think it's disinformation. I just think people are wrong. Mm-hmm. I've gotten this theory when I was in college. It was the war on drugs was to blame for everything. And a lot of people are ascribing the militarization of US policing to the war on drugs. That isn't actually the origin of all this paramilitary gear. Mm-hmm. It was after the Gulf War ended.
Yeah.
They wanted to keep the profits going for defense contractors. And some defense contractors, I got a buddy who works at a company who builds like bomb disarming robots. I don't know if you remember that case where somebody was shooting at police and they sent a robot in to subdue the guy instead of endangering police. That's one thing. That's like, that actually keeps people safe.
Yeah. But
what's happening is that the military wants new equipment. The military contractors, the companies that make this stuff, want to continue to sell gear. And they can't do it just on foreign wars. So they've started to sell things to local police departments. And the problem is when you have, I mean, I'm a techie, you know,
yes.
I like my cool toys. When you get a cool toy, you want to use that cool toy. And when
guilty as charged.
Yeah, when these cool toys are lethal, that's when you get into problems. I mean, I've been hearing about stuff like pepper bullets.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, it's I guess non-lethal, but pepper bullets, rubber bullets aren't enough. Pepper bullets. You know, meanwhile, up here, even at the G20 summit, people were outraged that they were getting stopped and told to move. It wasn't shoot first, ask questions, never. It was quite striking to see the news footage. Kudos to MSNBC's for some absolutely phenomenal on the ground reporting that the military, they look like military because they were in bloody camo gear in the middle of a city. It was the most absurd thing. They showed up, they got out of their vans, they started shooting. No warnings, no being told to leave the area. They just started throwing tear gas and shooting rubber bullets so quickly that the news crew, Ali Velshi and company. I love Ali Velshi. He's a Canadian dude. They started shooting so quickly, they didn't have time to get their masks on. So you got to see members of the media get tear gassed and hit in the knee with rubber bullets in real time.
Yep.
That is a complete failure of policing.
Yeah.
Under any, and people try to justify it. And this is where we get these a posteriori justifications for acts that people, sort of, they want to pick a particular side. They have an emotional attachment to a particular worldview. And so they piecemeal together, they patchwork together a combination of stuff that held together with glue and tape, but the logic almost holds to justify their pre-existing gut reaction. Jonathan Haidt talks about this in the book The Righteous Mind quite a bit. They're like, well, they were out after curfew. Serves them right. It's like, it doesn't matter if they're out after curfew. You give people a warning.
Yeah, when you have police behaving in the ways that police, fortunately, they've been documented.
Yes.
They have been thoroughly documented both by news media and by citizens. I mean, we have had an entire CNN crew arrested while live on the air.
Yeah, that was stupid.
And there was also documented documented evidence of police going up to a family driving by who were not involved in the protest,
yeah,
stopping their car, slashing their tires, opening the door, and tear gassing them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the police in the United States is out of control. It is now essentially a rogue element. And the reason for the rage is that on top of everything that we have pointed out, there's also the fact that the good old boy network exists. That the good old boy network has been in operation in police departments for generations. So
you know what? Can I just say something about that? This is one of the logical things that sort of, not logical, rhetorical elements of this whole issue in the U.S. that bugs me. And it bugs me because it makes the problem sound like something that is foreign in origin, as opposed to something that was made in the USA.
Yeah.
The reason that a lot of these police, whatever you want to call them, police states are the way they are is back in the day, you know, Mississippi burning era, local sheriff's departments, the police, they were all Klan. They were all KKK. And policing tends to be multi-generational. You're more likely to become a cop if your dad's a cop, if your granddad's a cop. Didn't happen in my family for whatever reason, but my great uncle was a railway cop. Nobody followed in his footsteps.
I did see in a police uniform last summer, though.
Yeah, that was a different thing. What happens there stays there. It involved a quasi-strip tease. That's a story for another time. I forgot about that. But, listening to my uncle, lovely guy, very progressive in his own way. He was Catholic. His wife wasn't. Neither family came to the wedding kind of thing. His funeral was the funniest funeral I've ever been to because the church – he was a member of all his life, changed, the neighborhood changed. Mm-hmm. And so it went from being majority white, you know, Irish Catholic, to majority non-white. And so this priest who did the funeral, he was like something out of a Mel Brooks movie. It was right around Easter. And so this guy, all I kept thinking is there was a character, I think, on the Smothers Brothers comic. My name, Jose Jimenez. That guy.
Yes.
He sounded like that. You'd swear this guy wasn't Latino or Hispanic. He was doing a character. But at one point he says, and the apostles, they were all Jew. And everybody.
Oh, my God.
Everybody in my family turns back and looks at me and my husband. And we just started laughing. And my family being who they are, everybody started laughing. And at the end, we're like, none of us were Catholic, right? We're like, we want that guy at our funeral. Book him now. But this makes him sound like a cuddly, warm, very progressive guy. And in many ways, he was. But when he talked about his days at a cop, he told stories about, you know, how they'd hit people with phone books to hide the bruises, and talked about arresting people for basically, being hobos. Essentially, they'd pick them up, stowing away on rail cars for the free transit, and they'd beat the crap out of them. And so this dichotomy of a very warm, not bigoted person who all of a sudden gets blue brain at work, it's a very real thing. There is something about the culture of policing going back ages that is unfortunately fueled and informed by some very, very, let's say, throwback thinking. And I think that's important to understand as we absorb this issue. This stuff doesn't come from nowhere. Mm-hmm. You know, it. What is that quote? Great minds discuss ideas, average minds discuss events, small minds discuss people. Is that the phrase?
I believe so.
Yeah, there's this tendency for people to focus on the actions of these cops. I mean, the riots are happening. We want them all arrested. We want them all charged. I think this is bad tactics, but we can get to that in a bit. You're not, at this point, if you only focus on the cops themselves and the actions of those cops, you demonize those cops, you don't get into the systemic problems of how bad people are allowed to become and stay police officers. You know, there are some great cops out there. I can't think of one that doesn't have an element of racist views. In my opinion, they're great people, but they start talking about race and you kind of change the subject. And, you know, one person I talked to explained it to me, and I'm not excusing this. I just think this is a critical thinking podcast, and I think it's important that we get all the cards on the table, like what causes police to behave so badly. And, you know, what this guy told me was everybody starts a beat cop. And when you're a beat cop, 90% of your interactions are with the same 10% of the population. Mm-hmm. After a while, you just get this instinctive reaction to, oh, is this going to be a new like person on the usual suspects list? And, you know, depending on the neighborhood, the group, the visible characteristics of that group, they tend to be homogenous because of the way poverty interacts with gangs and drugs and, you know, all that stuff. And it becomes this, because all the adrenaline's going and because it's a collection of split second decisions, the thinking becomes ingrained. Mm-hmm. And that, this is why I want to talk about this from a critical thinking perspective, because that's a learned response. So people aren't necessarily coming into the police force with bigotry, with racial ethnic. I lump that in because up here there's a real bias against Muslims among some cops. Mm-hmm. Here, especially ones that deal with terrorism. But they don't go in that way. They go in having never met a lot of people from these groups, and they don't see the people of the same background, the same sort of minority status, who are cops, as the same type of people. There's like subcategorization. So it's not black people overall that these cops have a bias towards. It's a certain type of black person, you know, meaning not cops. Right. And there is a severing of police from the rest of society. There's this sense, and I think that, you know, declaring war on all cops instead of bad cops is only going to make this worse and only going to make the problem harder to solve. This stuff is taught. This stuff is trained into them. And the reason that's important is, first of all, you can't screen it out because they don't go in with those views, but also what's taught can be untaught. It can be unlearned.
Of course, there is also the other side of the equation where you do have cops who are coming into the force already racist in many, many cases. For example, in the South, coming from families with a long history of racism.
Yes. Yeah. Dad was a cop. Granddad was a cop. Great-granddad might have been a cop. Yeah, they were all racist bastards, but they were cops.
Yes.
Right? Now, that's a different thing. That should be, you should be able to screen that out. Now, we have much greater screening up here than you guys do down there. And obviously, it's different state to state. But this goes into another, this touches on another issue I have with one of the demands of some of the protesters, which is defunding the police. We know when jobs become less lucrative, they pay less well, you know, the caliber of candidate you get for that job drops accordingly. You will get more white supremacist assholes in a police department if you cut the funding to a police department, because then the only reason someone would ever become a cop is if they have some sort of politically driven agenda. You know, now it could be very altruistic. It could be, I want to help my community. You know, I'm willing to take shit pay to help my community. But it's equally possible that, because, I mean, there is very compelling evidence that white supremacist groups are attempting to infiltrate, successfully infiltrating in a lot of ways, police services and the military to get firearms training, as scary as that is. you make policing less viable as a career, you get a higher percentage of people with negative ulterior motives. Did that make sense? Did that come across the way it sounded in my brain?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this is another reason why I want to talk about this, because I really understand the let's just get this done now instinct that people have, right? You know, let's just end the war on drugs. Let's just cut police. Let's just end police unions. We all know, have you seen that critical thinking cartoon where simple and wrong, complex nuance, but complicated, nuanced and right. And the simple but wrong, the path leads off a cliff. And the simple, you know, complex, nuanced but right is like this winding path up a road.
Yes.
They're doing the simple and wrong thing. Occam's razor is true sometimes. A lot of the time it's not. But they are plummeting off a cliff because any policymaker is just going to go, that is a non-starter. For very good reasons, right? Yeah. It's funny to me how many leftists are advocating for just stripping people of their collective bargaining rights and job protections. Because let's face it, police unions weren't created to defend racism. They do it, as do a lot of unions. Sorry to break it to people. You know, the NAACP did a huge expose on the ACL. And I believe it was the 70s, but it was research from the 60s that showed how unions were keeping out Black and brown people because they were good jobs and they wanted to keep the good jobs going to the white folk.
Yeah.
So this is a problem with all, this is a problem with all groups of people. The group is only as good as the people making up the group. Mm-hmm. And there's no way around that. We get so focused on systems that we forget that any system is open to manipulation. Any system is can be exploited. Any system can be turned into the exact opposite of what it was intended to be, because systems are made up of people, and no system can survive past a sort of event horizon of corrupt intent. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so I think there is something to be said for really looking at the people involved here and looking at, and I am very careful about, I am going to proceed with extreme caution here. Looking at the motivations factions involved in this debate have for holding the views they do. Mm-hmm. And some people say, but that's totally different than what you said in a past podcast. Yeah, that's why I said I'm extremely hesitant to go down there. I'm not saying to dismiss someone's point of view because they represent a particular group.
Right.
I'm saying be aware that a lot of people at the table in this whole thing may be engaging in shameless appeals to emotion, appeals to authority, and flat out sophistry of the highest and most craven order because there's a political agenda that they want to push. Mm-hmm. And that may not be a bad thing, but politics infects people. People get into politics and they may have had really good intentions going in, but politics very rapidly becomes politics for politics' sake because you have to get something done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I want to, I mean, obviously both of us are really pissed off about this, right?
Yes.
I mean, I think we've made that really clear at this point, but you know, we were able to sort of have a discussion here about, all right, we're pissed off. What do we do?
Yeah, we have to, people need to realize, yes, rioting is not logical, obviously, but we have to, you know, we have to look at the conditions that brought this about, and we have we have systemic injustice, systemic racism, and an entire population that is basically, Black people fear going out into the street because they're going to get, they fear they're going to get pulled over for no other reason than being Black. That shows that there is a problem and a an entire subset of the population who lives in the fear that they are a second-class citizen.
And let's be clear. This is a rational fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason to be afraid. This isn't just
fear for fear's sake.
This isn't somebody being overreactive. This is a real thing.
And the most galling thing is, of course, the Beckys and the Karens who are going, they should be protesting peacefully. Well, I am sorry, Karen, but you lost your shit when Colin Kaepernick took a knee.
Okay.
You got offended for that.
That's beautiful.
And so you lost your shit when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, but you did not lose your shit when this cop put his knee on the man's throat for 8 minutes.
See, I don't think those are Karens anymore. I think we have a new characterization. We have Amys now. We have Amys, the namesake of Amy Cooper.
Yeah.
The woman who, he happened to be a guy who was a publisher, an editor. Mm-hmm. Marvel,
Punisher,
and stuff like that.
Yep.
But here is a new force in the discourse, right? Mm-hmm. An upper middle class black man who knows his rights. Mm-hmm. Bless him. And his last name was Cooper too, Christian Cooper, right?
Yep.
Bless him, because there was a shining example of a guy who kept his cool. Even when she was doing everything she possibly could to
egg him on,
a reaction. Yeah, that man, he's a role model. Literally, the way role modeling is meant, like he was playing a role that we can model. The way he handled that, when she threatened to call the cops, he was just like, "Please do." I'm sure he was a little bit scared about that. He knew the risks inherent in that.
Yeah,
but he knew that she was doing that. She was trying to get under his skin in the most disgusting, craven way. And wow, have I seen that tactic duplicated by so many various actors online. But, you know, I think what shocked everybody, not only, you know, was she strangling her dog while claiming he needs the exercise as an excuse for a narcissism. Yeah. But the fact that she told him she was going to call and say she was being harassed by a black man, like just totally conscious, total forethought about the whole thing. But then she went through with it. You know, I think a lot of people might make that threat, but not really mean it. But something was off with that woman. Like, from the minute the camera started rolling, she was coming at him. She was being aggressive there. And that I think is very instructive when we see how this dialogue is being played out in America right now. There are a lot of groups that are camping on this issue. Mm-hmm. And again, I didn't, you know, if you'd told me a week ago that we were going to have to unpack the heuristics of rioting, I would have been, oh, good Lord, peak 2020. But, you know, it's not all right wingers, right? It's not all these neo-Klansmen who want to see an acceleration of America's descent into full police state. Or a destruction of current government institutions in all ways. Hate to break it to you folks, that isn't to bring in a liberal utopia. That is to bring in some sort of authoritarianism, and it doesn't matter what coat of paint they dress it up in, whether it's the supposed left or the alleged right. All these groups want to take away democratic institutions and replace them with some sort of, they can call it a lot of things, but it's a fascistic regime, right? Like, let's be pretty clear. And I don't like the, you know, accelerationists and all these new names that the identitarians, the pretty labels they slap onto. These are modern day Klansmen.
Yeah.
You know, They're burning stores instead of burning crosses in the woods, mm-hmm. and they're wearing black masks and stuff like that instead
because
of white
they know who's going they because they know who's going to get blamed for those actions.
Right, and you know they kind of overplayed their hand. These people are ballsy, but they're not very smart.
No, they're not.
But the fact that they went after CNN World Headquarters in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. That I mean, if somebody's running an op and that was actually an Antifa group that wanted to make Trump supporters look bad, that was pretty well played. I guess I shouldn't assume the Occam's razor on that one, but I think it's pretty obvious just sort of based on where it was and who the target was. The likelihood is those were people who leaned right, shall we say,
yeah.
You know? But I also noticed in the visuals of the looting, there were a lot more white faces among those rioters, mm-hmm. not the protesters, the rioters.
The rioters, yes.
Than supports the narrative that the protests just became violent. Those were people there to screw stuff up.
And we have footage of peaceful protests being approached by police who were clearly coming in ready to fight.
Yes.
Opening fire.
Yeah.
In this case,
gas
grenades and rubber bullets on peaceful protesters. You have photojournalist Linda Tirado,
yeah.
who was shot in the head and she lost
her
left
eye. Yeah. From cops. It's been pretty astounding to me, I admit, how quickly the cops are ready to shoot in these cases. Because I'll admit, I mean, our example in Toronto was the cops that apprehended that guy who drove a van down the sidewalk, claiming he was an incel. The restraint the police who apprehended him showed was inspirational. Because, you know, that's keeping your cool. The guy was trying to get taken out. And they wouldn't give him that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was, I mean, but this is the issue with police, right? What reward did those cops get for dealing with that well? We don't even know their names. I mean, we all know the name of this guy. I'm not going to repeat his name.
Yeah.
Who killed George Floyd.
Damnatio memoria.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, we don't know the names of cops that resist that urge. And it's the cops, it's the everybody that resists that urge that we really should be holding up for praise. Mm-hmm. And we're not doing it. And unfortunately,
yeah.
we're going into an election with two major party candidates who both have the instinct to get up in people's faces and get loud and get aggressive when they're confronted.
Yeah.
And it's like, damn, can somebody please put Joe Biden on Quaaludes or something? Like, can we calm him down? Because the gaffes, the stupid things, all that stuff, that's not going to hurt him. That urge to get his back up is going to be a real liability going forward, because people will be able to both sides that and go, oh, look, it's another contest between two old, angry white men running a campaign of you kids get off my lawn before I call the cops.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's an issue because we really do need leadership that goes beyond that. We're not getting it anytime soon. So, you know, community, and I hate to use the cliches, but on a community level, we have to figure out what we're going to do. Cause it's not stopping anytime soon. This bravado from people at the top. Maybe this is the time we should talk about how Trump really is a engine in this thing, how his example of when the looting starts, the shooting starts, like Do you think he didn't know the connotations of that?
See, it is so hard. It is so hard to judge what Trump actually knows, what he doesn't know. Mostly because, as far as I have seen, I believe there is a certain level of evidence to, in fact, suggest that the man is suffering from a type of dementia.
Right.
The posture, the mood swings, so many things point to him not being right.
And yet he's always been a massive brat, so it's impossible to tell.
If anything, you can always say that if he does indeed have this condition, the condition is merely, as such things do, especially in old age, exacerbate his traits.
Okay, so next question. Do you think somebody in his administration knew?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We're on the same page there.
We have people like Stephen Miller who there is evidence of him corresponding with white supremacists.
Yes.
There is no possible shadow of a doubt that the Trump White House is very cozy with many groups that favor white supremacy, that favor eugenist, I even hesitate to call them philosophies because eugenicism is not a philosophy.
Yeah.
Eugenicist superstition.
Right. That's a good way to say it. I mean, yeah, it's almost like a lot of people saw Trump as an opportunity, and all the smart and evil people are lining up behind this guy who just, I don't know if he has firmly held beliefs enough to be traditionally defined as a racist. He sure amplifies racism.
Yeah, I think Trump is more of a James Taggart than anything else.
For people who don't know what that is, you better define that.
So James Taggart, take a hit.
Yeah.
Take a shot. In Ayn Rand's novel, Atlas Shrugged, James Taggart is the primary villain. He is a millionaire businessman, so that kind of shatters a couple of assumptions about Ayn Rand. But he's a billionaire businessman who uses his power to influence government in favor of his cronies.
Right.
And so he steps on a lot of honest businessmen, both especially small independent businesses that are promising and that might potentially be his competition. He uses politics of pull to take over businesses, such as Trump did when he used eminent domain to evict people who would not sell their properties to him.
Right.
And he is a mass of neuroses, constantly preoccupied with what people say about him. He is constantly worried about the image of him as the great producer and the great businessman being challenged, because he knows it's false, because he's not a great businessman and he's not a great producer. He is a leech. A leech who just happened to be born into wealth and used that wealth.
We're still describing James Taggart, Donald Trump.
And so at the end of the novel, he essentially just has a massive psychological, becomes a completely useless, blubbering creature. Again, still describing James Taggart here.
Yeah.
But I think that in many cases, because then, of course, when the man that James Taggart's little clique gets to become the head of the government, James Taggart, of course, becomes a very prominent government player. Then there's a whole bunch of infighting between all of the different cronies, and the more brutal and more militaristic ones, such as Coffee Meigs, start getting a stronger hand in government. The government becomes more authoritarian. There's a stronger motion for police force, etc.
We're still talking about the book.
Yeah, once again, we're talking about the book, but you can see where the parallels are going here.
Yeah, there's a reason we talk about Ayn Rand so much on this podcast. It's just the philosopher for the times in many ways.
Atlas Shrugged was supposed to be a warning, not a documentary.
The thing that I think is also relevant about Atlas Shrugged is people, you know, Ayn Rand, when she talked as herself, there was a very scalpel-like reasoning. She just cut away, right? It was like a laser cutter, right?
Yeah, she was like a little Russian robot when she spoke.
Yeah, and she just went for it. But her fiction writing, it's like she knew she had a tendency to be cerebral, and so she just bombarded the reader with emotion and purple prose to connect.
She grew up loving the novels of Victor Hugo and Alexandre Dumas and all of those romanticist writers who had a tendency. I mean, if you go through the Hunchback of Notre Dame, or if you read Les Misérables, there is a lot. If you read Les Misérables, Jean Valjean does not come in for quite a while because there is so much time that is spent on the priest.
Yes.
And, you know, you can see where Ayn Rand got that style, that propensity, because she loved the romanticist literature school. And so when she wrote Atlas Shrugged, she was... as some would say, she was bold steep in that. In that literature style, which you don't really see in things like We the Living or Anthem.
Yeah.
Atlas Shrugged was, in her mind, it was kind of a romanticist piece. But yeah, the James Taggart is also not as intelligent as he wants people to believe. He, of course, thinks he's a genius.
He's not a stable genius. Again, yeah, we're talking about the fictional character, not Donald Trump.
And he gets used by a lot of people who see him as a great opportunity to get a leg up and get a go at the controls once he climbs up high enough that he has access to government power. And so, in this case, I am pretty confident, and in fact I wrote a whole essay about why Trump and James Taggart are basically the same person.
I don't think it's just Trump, though. I think James Taggart is the cautionary tale for this whole mess we're in right now, because it's a lot of people that the minute you attempt to inject any sort of accountability for anything,
they try to pass the buck.
Yeah, but they also start wailing, right? They start wailing. They're offended. They're hurt. All this stuff. It just is this language of emotion.
And that's exactly what James Taggart does when he says, I can't be blamed. Nobody could have predicted that. It's not my fault. I don't take responsibility.
Again, this is James Taggart, not
this
Donald
is James,
Trump.
This is James Taggart.
But again, it's not just Trump. If Trump were a fictional character, people would say he would be too on the nose in terms of being an embodiment of sort of the zeitgeist of our era.
I know that's one of the funny things. One of the first things I heard as criticism of Ayn Rand is that her characters were too stilted and too unbelievable.
Yes. Yes.
But I mean, look at it.
I really believe that a lot of that criticism, and there are other stories like that as well, that people who make those criticisms are just too close to the people who are being examined, and so they reject the message.
I mean, look at Mitch McConnell, for crying out loud.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of that again. There's a lot of that going on with what's going on in Minneapolis and the rest of America right now, that everybody wants to be able to say racism is terrible and somebody else does it.
Yeah.
And I've been watching, I think the mayor of Minneapolis is in a terrible spot, and I think that he's conducting himself pretty well. He's using the mayor of St. Paul, who is Black, as something of a shield, but I think perhaps if I were him, I'd be doing the same thing. I think Amy Klobuchar's VP aspirations are done, and that's not fair. I think people are, this is an issue with the way, who America blames for its ills. And there's this war on not just cops right now, but prosecutors, right? Mm-hmm. As if prosecutors make laws. You know, one of the things that sucks about being a lawyer is if you're a defense attorney, you have to defend people who are guilty.
Yeah.
You don't get into the law to defend guilty people. You get into the law to defend innocent people. But there's not enough money defending innocent people, right?
Right.
So lawyers have to defend guilty people of the defense attorneys, but prosecutors have to prosecute based on the laws that legislators make. They do not get to decide whether they agree with a law. They have to prosecute according to what the law says. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's a nuance that's really being lost here.
And a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the idea that they could get a first degree murder charge to stick on this cop when he's going to have the best lawyers the alt-right can buy.
Right. Also, there is some misconception among people about what the degrees mean.
Yeah.
I see that a lot of people have the assumption that the degrees mean the level of atrocity, and it's not the case.
Right.
First degree murder is premeditated murder, which means you need to be able to show premeditated prior to the situation intent to kill this person, such as, you know, conspiracy to commit murder. Third degree is manslaughter, which can be intentional or accidental, which is the most appropriate to this, unless, of course, and of course this is incredibly probable, but unless you can show evidence that the policeman in question knew that this man was going to be there and engineered the circumstances so that he would be able to kill him
beyond a reasonable doubt.
Now, considering the situation, it is very, very, very unlikely, unless we're talking about a plot of Machiavellian proportions. It is most accurate that he be tried for a third degree, which is manslaughter.
Yeah. Also, let's face it, it wasn't that personal. He saw a black guy.
Yeah.
And that's why he acted the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's his wife's divorcing him.
Yep.
Like, it was immediate. Like, I'm out of here. I'm disgusted. She's Asian.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously she'd heard things that she didn't agree with. She was on the edge. You don't just divorce your husband over something like this unless you were halfway out the door.
Well, he also sounds like he had a history, so I think this was coming for a while.
Yeah.
But, you know, this gives her the opportunity to probably do something she has been wanting to do for a while because she was married to an apparent piece of shit.
Yeah. But again, putting all the blame on the shoulders of the specific cops in question and anybody who ever, you know, got sneezed on by them, this is totally contrary to the stated goals of the activists making these claims, which is an examination of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where the anthropologist in me kicks in, because either a person is a product of the system, therefore behaving in a way that the system informs, or they are an aberration. And we really have to decide which this is. And I don't know. I just think that this is happening way too often to dismiss it as blue man bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just cops, right? I mean, Ahmaud Arbery, that was an ex-cop, but, you know, he took self-defense to such a ludicrous extreme that he decided to track the man and shoot him.
Yes.
Because he peeked in at a construction site on his neighbor's property.
Mm-hmm.
That, I don't know how U.S. laws work. I believe they're pretty screwed up, but that isn't defense of your own property under any interpretation of the law, as I understand it.
Yeah, it is. It simply is not.
Yeah. And I don't know if the guy hadn't have done the exact same thing if he'd been white. I suspect not. I suspect if he'd been white, he'd have gone and yelled at him and maybe brandished the gun at him. But that's the difference between somebody you see as a disgusting human being and something you see as an entirely different species. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yes.
And that's a big problem that I don't hear a lot of discussion of. And it goes back to the racism episode we did. You know, at the core of this, logically, critically, to quote George Orwell, clearly, if people will believe this kind of thing, one will not get much further by arguing with them. The only useful approach is to discover why they can swallow absurdities on one particular subject while remaining sane on others. And to me, I've been thinking about this a lot. At the core of racism is a need for certainty. People want to be able to look at somebody and know exactly what they're going to get. And they've been raised in soups where you look at somebody, you know exactly what you're going to get. Because, oh my God, you can spot a redneck across a football field. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all kind of, the guy with the bow and arrow in the protests, you see, like in the video, you see the bow first and then you see his face and you're like, uh-huh, of course.
Yeah.
Same with the guy who shot Arbery, you know, say you see even the cop, you know, even the cop that killed George Floyd, you look at him and he looks exactly like the kind of guy who would do this sort of thing. And like, he looks like one of the HR dudes from Person of Interest. You know, yeah. I don't know if you watch that show, but I love that show. But you know, these are people that just conform to stereotypes. And so somebody who conforms to stereotypes just assumes that everybody conforms to stereotypes. People tend to assume other people will approach problems exactly the way they do.
Like there's a saying in Spanish, cada ladrón juzga por su condición, which roughly translates to every thief judges by his condition.
Yeah. Yeah, which is apt, right? I mean, everybody just assumes, and it tells you a lot about the values with which the racists are raised. And I say that racists of any color, because mm-hmm. let's face it, racism is not just a white on black problem.
Yeah.
Good Lord, you look into the history of Asia, you discover that it's not that. But you know,
you look at the history of my country, where you have people with mixed blood, with tan skin, being prejudiced against people with darker skin and worshiping people with lighter skin. Yeah,
that's when it becomes a fucking Star Trek episode.
But it really kind of is.
I noticed this in the people that decided to tell me to shut up and go read a book and all that stuff on Twitter. And I always find the go read a book thing on Twitter really an odd one, because you're talking about a medium where people communicate in text.
Yes.
Everybody on Twitter is literate to one degree or another. I always think, and I could be totally wrong here, this is half a joke, but maybe you can see a flaw in my thinking here. People who say, go read a book. Reading books is still novel for these people. You know what I mean? Like, they read a book out of the five they own with no pictures, and it changed their life. And they're very proud of themselves that they read a book. And so their advice to other people, even though it's you know, it's insulting, it's intended to be derisive, is go read a book, assuming that people have bad ideas because they have not enough information, as opposed to the truth of a lot of people on this issue. They're overwhelmed with information. They have been so just barfed on by statistics and theories and sermons and information. You know, you'll never see somebody who's a more voracious reader than a white supremacist. They're constantly on those sites reasserting their views. You know, they're listening to the podcast. They're reading the books. They're reading the pamphlets. They read voraciously because they have to block out the doubt, mm-hmm. right? People think that racists are inherently ignorant. They're not. They're people who are very determined to maintain that certainty. The people who are different from them are evil. And I really think it's because they've built up this giant wall in their mind against paralyzing fear.
Yeah, at the heart, I've been thinking about this. At the heart of every prejudice, at the heart of every war, at every moment of intolerance, there is a collectivist premise at work. The desire to belong to one group and for that group to be the right group, which immediately makes all of the other
also,
not your groups.
Also a group you cannot be removed from.
Exactly.
And that's why identifiable groups are so tempting, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't be removed from being white.
Well, you can, depending.
They are not going to remove you from being white because you can't change that.
Except, you know, that's this question of white fragility. I mean, I always kind of amazed, you know, Christian Piccolini, the mm-hmm. reformed white supremacist. I always thought it was interesting that his name's Piccolini.
Yes.
And I mean, there was a time where Italians, sir, were not considered white. Mm-hmm. You know, the Irish weren't considered white. And that's the thing. Whiteness is fluid. Now, some of these guys, I say this seriously, they're inbred. So yeah, they're probably pretty white.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think sometimes, you know, these guys who are on the less learned end of the scale, who, you know, grew up on a mountain in Eastern Kentucky where their family's been for 3 years and they ain't leaving even though the coal mine closed. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing they got is that heritage, that idea that it's not that you're inbred, it's that you're pure.
Yeah.
But then you get guys like Stephen Miller, who, for God's sakes, he's a conservative Jew.
Who has been pretty much excommunicated, so to speak, from his family. Every single member of his family absolutely loathes him.
Well, I think guys like him, too, they feel like they need to work harder to prop up their whiteness because mm-hmm. they are on the margins of it, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, guys like him being, you know, being cut off from your family, everybody telling you you're wrong. I joke about this a lot, but you want to convince a white guy he's correct?
Tell him
he's
wrong.
Yell at him. And that's not just exclusively to white guys. I encountered some black anti-capitalists on Twitter this week. Some of them, I give credit to the ones that came out and had Marxist in their profile. I give them points for honesty for that one. But the anti-capitalist, it's the same thing. You know,
it's a different brand.
They're no different than any other troll group in that they travel the internet in packs, mm-hmm. right? So you're very quickly not dealing with just one of them. You're dealing with six in a matter of minutes, and they broadcast their conversation to, you know, their comrades.
And so they can come in and dogpile in as well. Yeah.
They're dogpiling, but they're dogpiling with a purpose. And this happened so many times to me this week, trying to discuss this issue with so many disparate groups. So like alt-right, flat-out trolls, anti-feminist, white racist, but then these black Marxists as well. I got confused of which one I was dealing with because the tactics were very similar. And what they're designed to do, it is not about me when they come at me. And it is not about you when they come at you.
It's a performance for others.
It is reasserting the echo chamber. The same thing mm-hmm. I said about them reading, because they constantly have to reassert their inherently absurd ideas. And what they are attempting to prove through this performative exercise is that you are no better than them. They abuse you and hurl insults and attempt to shame you and call you names, trying to get you to explode and start being just as abusive to them as they are to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I find knowing that stops me from falling into that trap, knowing that that's their win condition to get me to get so angry, because they're not trying to persuade me. There's nothing about their tactics that are at all persuasive.
No.
And I thought it was interesting that I said to this one guy who was just for the record, one of these black Marxists, which to be clear, I'm distinguishing that they are Marxists because Marxists are a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of all Americans.
Like, yes.
Tiny. So black Marxists are even stronger. And I want to be clear, I do not believe for a second that they actually speak for, you know, hardworking, just regular black people trying to live their lives and not get killed by cops. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
I said to one guy, what is this accomplishing? You know, other than showing that you're very, very angry, which is fair, and you have that right, what does this do? The guy disappeared. And that really surprised me because I was prepared for another wave of abuse with that, telling me that me agreeing with them on anything was somehow oppressive and a form of white supremacy. And that's the other thing I noticed about these people. They scream insecurity. Mm-hmm. People, you had a dealing with a guy like this too.
Oh yeah.
They claim not to care, but everything they do indicates that they care very much. And there's some sort of inverted approval seeking going on with these guys that is really, really interesting. Because fighting, like, people don't do things just because. Fighting with people, acting like an abusive asshole on Twitter or Facebook or medium of your shitpost choice. It's not even shitposting because they're emotionally engaged, right?
That's right.
That does something for the person. And it seems to be this combination of self-flagellation, like a form of odd, almost autoerotic punishment, like self-punishment.
Now there's an image.
Yeah, but there is. There's an ecstasy that comes across in these guys. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels like, you know, those monks that, like, flailed themselves and cut their backs open because they got this...
And wore the hair shirts.
Yeah. They got this sort of ecstatic charge from being kind of miserable. And you know, some people's physiologies are trained that way. I knew guys who hung themselves from meat hooks for performance art. And apparently some people just have a different endorphin response to pain, be it emotional or physical. But there's a desire to seek out abuse in these groups that I'm trying to figure out, is that innate and so it just makes people vulnerable, or has this been trained into them by the very groups that they get their identity from? You know, because all these groups is a process of tearing you down so you'll be admitted, and then they remake you in their image, right? Because it's always everything you've learned is wrong. You're part of the problem. You can only be part of the solution through us. Question nothing we say from this point forward or you're bad.
Yeah. Which is, you know, cultish behavior.
Well, yeah. And it doesn't matter who's doing it. And it's unfortunate because I think a lot of the well-meaning white people who were involved in some of these debates have been so shamed into believing that they're secretly horrible lurking racists that they don't show certain black people enough respect to ever question their assertions. Mm-hmm. And I personally, I don't know how you feel. You're closer to this than I am. But do you find that insulting when people won't challenge a person of color the way they challenge a white person who came on and made a contentious statement?
Yes. Speaking as a minority myself.
Yeah, that's why I'm opening this.
I think that if you find yourself not challenging someone on anything that you consider, you know, a fallacious statement, bad reasoning, etc., solely because they're a minority, you're treating them like children. And
yeah,
and here's the thing: just because someone is a minority, just because someone has experienced hardship, it does not create some level of omniscience. Here's the thing. I can experience prejudice. I can experience racism. I can experience homophobia. I can experience religious persecution. And while I may be, for example, I may be accurate about what it is that I experienced, insofar as, yes, I have, say, the Catholic League after me trying to get me fired because I'm an atheist, mm-hmm. or whatever, I can be pretty darn wrong.
Yeah.
About higher abstractions, about the root cause of one problem or another related to my experiences. I am not infallible simply because I was persecuted.
Well, and let's face it, a lot of these problems have to do with highly, highly subjective frameworks, right? Because it's all about how people perceive each other. It's almost like the existentialists were right to an extent. And I can't believe I said that.
But there's also the problem of nuance. For example, like you said, focusing on the bad behavior of individual cops with a laser focus makes you blind to the nuance of the institutional issues,
right,
and how to properly dismantle the insidious institutional racism and authoritarianism that exists in our current police culture, which also is tied to the racism and authoritarianist streaks running through government,
yeah,
and which is reinforced in many ways by collectivist messages that are imparted to people in schools. If you focus on that particular thing with a laser focus, you're essentially the fable of the blind man and the elephant.
That's a really good point.
Which I don't know. I don't know how familiar people are.
Tell it so people know. Self-reference.
So there is a fable. I read this when I was a kid, but there were a number of blind wise men who wanted to know what an elephant was. And so they mm-hmm. went to the king and they requested that they be given an elephant to study. And, you know, the king acquiesced and brought in an elephant. So these men, each one of them grabbed a different part of the elephant. For mm-hmm. example, one grabbed the trunk, the other one grabbed a leg, another one grabbed a tusk, the other one grabbed a tail, the other one was grabbing its gigantic torso, and each one of them asserted that an elephant was the particular body part,
yeah,
that they were grabbing. So one would say, you know, an elephant is this fleshy, very flexible nozzle, mm-hmm. and the other one said, no, an elephant is this very, very thin, waving thing, and so on and so forth. Because, of course, each one was only grabbing one part of the problem, and they were not, you know, they were also contending that each one of them had grasped the true essence of the elephant.
Yeah.
They had worked together to put the different bits of data together, they would have had a much more accurate representation of what an elephant is. But because they were fractionary and they were essentially competing against each other as to who had the absolute truth and the absolute piece of information, they never were able to actually understand what an elephant was.
Yeah, which goes back to that idea of anybody who tries to convince you that the issues behind the rioting right now are easy to solve. Not easy, but simple to solve. You know, they have a few easy steps to, this is what we have to do, defund the police, you know, end the war on drugs. It's not that simple. That is the blind man and the elephant.
So ending the war on drugs is an excellent goal, but
oh, very important.
It's not the panacea, because, and you, when you were telling me about these people who were telling mm-hmm. you that, you know, it was all because of the war on drugs, I told you it's an inversion of
yes.
cause and effect.
Yep.
Because in many ways the war on drugs is being used to target African American communities is not a cause, it's the effect. It is the effect of racism. If the war on drugs did not exist, and it did not exist for quite a long time, policemen and government still found ways to screw with minorities and black people.
Emmett Till predated the war on drugs.
Yeah. So it is, you know, ending the war on drugs is a very, very important, it's basically, it's prohibition 2.0. It's just as useful as prohibition. And the only thing it has done is give power to criminal cartels. And ruin the lives of many people who have committed nothing more than victimless crimes.
Of numerous races.
But in and of itself, it is not the panacea. It is, you can say, you can definitely say that ending the war on drugs will end a preferred tactic that is used by racist institutions to target minorities, and that is a perfectly viable point. But what's going to happen is, unless you address the issue of institutionalized racism, unless you start solving that, all that is going to happen is that they will simply shift tactics.
Yep, because the justification for the shootings isn't he was on drugs. Mm-hmm. The justification for the shootings or the chokeholds or all this stuff is he resisted.
Yes.
And that, it doesn't matter why the altercation began. It's that for some odd reason, some people are just, you know, if you think about it, we all have bad days, right? Yeah. You know, we all have those days where it starts off not great. Sometimes there are really good reasons. Sometimes there aren't. It sounds like this dude was having some marital trouble, you know? But you're just a powder keg, and we don't teach people how to, first of all, be present enough, self-aware enough to know I'm a powder keg. There's certain things I shouldn't attempt to do today. And, you know, a guy like George Floyd is just the unlucky person who became the outlet for someone's bottled up rage. Because we do not teach people. And it's easy to say we do not teach men. But again, the Amys.
Yes.
The Amys are very, very angry women. And don't let the victim routine fool you. That woman's angry.
Yeah. And here's the thing. That's another thing is also that with... You know, we keep touching about what happened in the 50s to both men and women. But, you know, in the 50s, you had the image of the stoic man, but also a kind of fetishization of anger and rage used against people that
angry
were
black
clearly,
men, angry woman, angry Latino, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anybody who's not a white male, they get branded by their anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, so you have this this amazing paradox where men are supposed to be stoic, unemotional. But then, of course, that leaves them completely unable to deal with their anger when it arises. They don't know how to deal with it.
But I also think that's part of the charisma of Trump.
Oh, God.
I think the fact that, no, I think this is really being
I know, and world. I just hate that you had to use Trump and charisma in one phrase.
Oh, no, Trump, okay. Trump is very charismatic. Like, if first edition Dungeons & Dragons were written today, an evil, no. Because you know how they got in so much trouble for saying Hitler was an example of a character who is not terribly smart, not terribly... you know, wise or dexterous, but he was charismatic.
Yeah.
And he wasn't a good person either. He was just charismatic.
I know.
Today, it would be Donald Trump in that example. And people would go crazy as well. But there is a charisma to the fact that he is a constant raw wound. And I really think it's an aspirational thing that all these men who are super bottled up, they think, if I'm as rich as him, even though he's not as rich as he claims, I will be able to have these emotional meltdowns in public and nobody close to me is allowed to judge me. I really think that's part of the appeal. I think there is something aspirational about Trump's complete lack of emotional control. Mm-hmm. You know, he's rioting every single day. He's just got enough power that he doesn't have to break stuff. He says, "You break that thing for me," you know, like it's Burns kind of thing. And I really think that everybody is just so tired of being afraid and tired of being angry and tired of feeling helpless, that there is something really seductive about a guy who's that hot a mess. Not that I'm saying he's hot. Hot as in hot under the collar, not, oh God, let's stop now. Okay, yeah. I think next week, because we did sort of how to not get baited. And again, my suggestion is, remember, that's what they want you to do. They mm-hmm. want you to get openly angry. Don't give them that satisfaction. That's the only thing that keeps me from doing it sometimes. But I think next week we're going to have to deal with anger, yes. And reason. I know we've touched on it before, but this is a different paradigm because we're out of time now. Mansplaining's got to record. But okay, so this has been the Broken Clock Podcast. Yada, yada, yada. Patreon, merch, all that good stuff. FUnetwork.tv. Thinking is good for you, even when it hurts sometimes. Please keep that emotional and don't hurt yourself or others physically. Mouse, as usual, you have the last word.
That's a hard thing to summarize.
Yeah.
Oh, remember, they want you to be angry.
This is fun! The FU Network!